Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Granted, just one big wish. A lot of people these days might wish for an alternative to fossil fuels. They are fouling the planet, but we want and need energy. M. Sanjan, lead scientist for the Nature Conservancy, has traveled the world looking at the leading edge of new energy options. He's back to tell us what's out there, what we can hope for, and what we can't. This hour, On Point, desperately seeking alternative energy. You can join the conversation. Can we move on from oil? Do you see sufficient energy options now or soon or ever? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Missoula, Montana, is M. Sanjan. He's the host of the new Discovery Channel four-hour series, Powering the Future, which looks at the quest for a global supply of limitless clean energy. Sounds great. He's also a wildlife biologist and the lead scientist for the Nature Conservancy. M. Sanjan, thank you very much for being here today.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me on Point.
So you've been all over the place. I mean, you've been in all over the U.S., all over China. You've been in Germany. You came back pretty optimistic. Let's just hear a little bit from here you are as part of the Discovery series, Powering the Future, at the National Ignition Facility in Livermore, California, where scientists are trying to achieve nuclear fusion. At the center of those efforts is a giant sci-fi looking machine attempting to replicate the energy production of the sun. Here you are.
This multi-billion dollar machine is made of 192 lasers. The lasers have to strike a hydrogen-filled capsule the size of a pea. To trigger fusion, all the lasers must hit the target at exactly the same time. A direct hit, hydrogen atoms fuse, and you have clean, limitless energy forever.
Cue timpani drums. Discovery Channel brings it on with M. Sanjan and a pretty optimistic view from some of the scientists you talked to as well. Here's Don Sadoway, an MIT scientist developing large-scale liquid batteries. That sounds cool. He pushes back on the idea that our energy future is going to mean cutting back on our energy lifestyle.
Now, a lot of people seem to think that in order to conserve, they have to go back living on the land wearing a loincloth or something, and it doesn't have to be that.
Limitless energy, no loincloth required. So what's the view you come out of this with, M. Sanjan?
Well, you have to remain optimistic about it because, anything other than that, and, you might as well go home. So, most of the scientists we spoke to were people who, by nature, were working on the cutting edge of technology. And if you're doing that, you are going to be optimistic. Why would you embark upon a research program if you didn't think it was actually going to solve a piece of the societal problem? But, I went on this big journey. And just so your audience knows, mm-hmm. I didn't go to every place you see on screen. We had four producers doing this simultaneously
taking
for each episode.
Taking the cameras out, yep.
Exactly. And they flew me around to the different places that made sense for me to, be
sure.
There as a host to bridge
mm-hmm.
something. Mm-hmm. But, Puerto Rico, China, southern United States, New York, Shanghai. We went to the Gulf. And, of course, we spent a lot of time in California. And I came away with really two things. The first is I, as a scientist even, knew incredibly little about energy, this thing that sort of dominates human civilization. I would give myself a D, maybe a D+, before this show. And that was shocking to me, that when I really dug into it, yeah, I used energy all the time,
mm-hmm.
but I just equated it with the price I pay at the gas, when I go to pump up gas. So I came away with this notion that I didn't know very much, but once I learned about it, I realized how enormous the challenge really is. And then I came away with a bit of optimism because there was literally thousands or tens of thousands of people around the planet working on fixes for small pieces of that. So, you sort of have to temper it. You definitely get optimistic when you meet these individuals who are creating, jobs, creating new industries, creating new technology. But then you're sobered by the gigantic nature of the problem.
Shell Oil is one of your maybe your big sponsor here. It's not a don't worry, be happy petroleum message we're hearing.
No, and you know I'm not exactly sure what the relationship with Shell is. You know, Discovery Channel has many corporate sponsors who sponsor varieties of programs. In no way did it impact our filming of things on the ground. We were allowed to go wherever we wanted. We went to many different companies, some who you know show up as sponsors during your commercial breaks, and some who don't. So that decision that was taken by Discovery Corp was completely separate from myself and certainly from our production crew. That said, we did manage to get onto a Shell oil platform, a big rig out in the Gulf, and spend a couple of days there, which was a really incredible eye-opening thing. I doubt we would have got permission to do that today. I mean, we might have, but
after the Deepwater Horizon went down,
exactly.
Standing there, did you think, oh my gosh, I'm standing on a powder keg here. One of these rigs could go down, and we'd have the BP challenge we have today. Or did it?
No, you know that's the thing. You know, I was stunned at how remarkably safe it seemed. I mean, they put you through a whole weekend of training about how to get out of helicopters if they go underwater. I mean, they really pushed the training.
But emphasis now has to be on seamed. I mean, we're looking at the Gulf, and it is fouled.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you know, that's a really interesting point. So you fly out there, and we went out about 100 miles off the coast, and you pass all these rigs. When you get onto this particular rig that I was on, one called Brutus, it does seem safe. And you look below it, and the water seems crystal blue. You can see big, giant barracuda swimming below it. There's about 100-plus men on this oil rig, and there was not even graffiti in the bathroom.
Yeah, nevertheless, I mean, the Gulf is now spoiled. Take us away from oil. It's
sure.
Not where we want to go. Take us to, I don't know, take us on your tour. Give us some alternatives out there that look promising.
Well, you know, the point I was trying to make on that, all I was trying to make was that it is deceptive. So, you know, you really see something on the surface, you have to dig deeper. Because what I see now today is very different from, you know, that little experience a few months ago.
Dig down on an alternative or two for us. We're eager to get there.
So what, in terms of alternatives, you know, the things that I was really impressed with was the potential for wind. And really everywhere we went, we saw a lot of emphasis going into wind energy. And if I had money to invest in one of these technologies, that's probably where I would put a lot on it. But, you know, you saw the whole spectrum of it from things that were in place today, solar thermal water heaters in China going up into villages that never had hot water before, to, you know, changing all the windows on the Empire State Building to make them about 30% more efficient, the entire building make it 30% more efficient, to things that were still a little bit out there. The giant turbines on kites that are flown at high altitudes, they're in testing phase. Solar paint, on the other hand, is still in really the experimental phase. So you saw the whole spectrum.
M. Sanchin, we actually have your kite energy guy with us right now. From Alameda, California. Corwin Hardam is with us. He's CEO of Makani Power, wind engine company that builds kite-mounted turbines. I had not heard of this before. Google has. I guess they've invested. Corwin Hardam, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello there.
We think we know about wind power from those tall towers and the big fan blades. What are you doing with kites? How's that work?
Well, it is a little bit different. There are some similarities with the conventional three-bladed turbines. Basically, what you can think about is if you imagine your typical turbine, as you see the tall ones you see on the side of the road.
Yeah.
If you take one of the blades off, and instead of constraining it to circle around a central hub, instead think about tying it to a tether and letting it fly almost like a stunt kite up higher in the sky. That's very similar to what we're doing here. So it is a wing, but it is tethered to the ground, and it does look like one blade of a turbine flying around in a pattern.
What's the advantage?
Well, there are many advantages. The main advantage is that you get to sweep through a lot more area with a lot less material. And because of that, what we see is we're able to generate about twice as much energy with about a fifth the amount of material as a conventional turbine.
How high is this thing flying, spinning?
It's about 400 meters off the ground.
400 meters. So what's going on up there? That's not high enough to be jet stream. What happens at 400 meters that doesn't happen at ground level?
Right. So you do get a little bit of an advantage from being up off the ground. So We see even at 400 meters, we get about a 2x increase in power density in the wind. But the major advantage of this technology is actually that we sweep through a much larger amount of area. So the big, or I'd say one of the biggest problems with renewable energy is that the power density, the amount of energy going through a certain area of space, the energy flux, is quite low. And what we're doing with this technology is we're able to intercept a very large amount of it with very little amount of material.
And if the wind dies off, does it crash to the ground like my kite did when I was 8 years old?
No, fortunately it doesn't. So one of the nice things about, we have these little rotors on the wing, and in fact it actually looks like a propeller aircraft, but instead of using the rotors to drive the plane forward, we're actually using the rotors to slow it down. However, if the wind dies, what we can do is put a little bit of power back up the tether and then add some thrust in to keep it up in the air.
That is pretty incredible. How much of this country's energy supply, this country alone, do you think wind could one day supply, Coleman Hardam?
Well, wind could supply all of our energy needs, which is one of the reasons why it's so exciting. It's, of course, it is a... It's very easy to say that, and it's a true statement. It's very difficult to actually to do because of all the transmission challenges.
All of our energy needs? Would that make the skies just one big cloud of blades spinning?
No, it wouldn't, actually. Wind energy is quite dense, and there's a lot of it. One of the neat things about this technology in particular is because of the large swept area I was just referring to, basically that translates into very good light wind performance, which further translates into you can put this just about anywhere you want.
Coleman Hardam, it's great to have you with us. It's kind of an incredible story. We've got more energy, alternative energies to get to, but we wish you luck at Makani Power. Thank you very much for joining us from Alameda.
Great. Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking after the Gulf oil blowout about getting off oil, about alternative energy ideas from around the world, anything but oil. M. Sanjun is with us. He's lead scientist for the Nature Conservancy and host of the new Discovery Channel series, Powering the Future. He's been chasing down a lot of ideas, some you've heard of, some you may not have heard of. Wind power mounted on kites, you just heard right there. Here's Saul Griffith, one of the a physicist and inventor in California that M. Sanjun talked to in his travels. Energy, he says, is all around us.
Energy is not obvious to us. We don't really see the wind, but we feel the wind. We feel the solar energy as warmth on the side of our face. It's not intuitive because it's not visible. But if we start to look a little more carefully, we start to see all the energy around us, both the ways that we use energy, but also all of the energy forms that we could be using to power humanity.
And you might find it in unexpected places, the Discovery series tells us, M. Sanjun tells us. He goes to a Puerto Rican rainforest, talks with synthetic biologist Jay Kiesling, who's searching for an enzyme that might unlock the power of cellulosic ethanol from corn stalks, all kinds of organic material.
It's incredibly cool. It's incredibly cool, right? I mean, we're taking biomass, which is combustible, but not in a form that you would necessarily want to put in your gas tank, and changing it into a chemical form that's extremely combustible, has a great deal of energy per pound, and that will fire your engine, allow you to drive down the road.
M. Sanjun, take us into that one, the magic enzyme he's looking for. What would it do?
Well, most of the stuff that we make out of biomass today really ends up using up food products like the kernels and the corn. Mm-hmm. And his point is, well, why can't we use all the waste, all the stuff that you essentially throw away, the corn husk, if you will.
Sawdust, and wood chips, you name it.
Exactly. Really anything that's biodegradable. But to do that, you need to come up with a pretty powerful enzyme that can break up cellulose. And cellulose is very strong. It's what give plants their structure and strength. And where better to find it but in a place where rot happens quickly. And rot happens quickly in the rainforest. Leave a pair of sneakers out for a couple of days in the rainforest and you'll see what happens. And so that's what he's on. He's on a quest to find the best enzymes he can from bacteria that live in the rainforest jungles that are rotting away, you know, the leaves and the trees and things like that. And if he can do that and do that at a scale, then you really have, you've unlocked a way to take all the stuff that we consider quote-unquote waste. And instead of waiting in your compost heap for many months for it to be turned back into something useful, you can turn it into something useful very quickly.
So there's waste, there's wind. You looked at solar as well. Went to Spain to do that. What's the leading edge on solar today?
Well, you know, the solar right now, you know, there's a couple of different ways of which it's going. You know, the cells themselves, the photovoltaic cells, are getting more and more efficient. And that's definitely being, you know, getting better and getting cheaper all the time. But there's other things that are being adopted as well. And I didn't really quite understand the difference. And that's just, you know, solar thermal heaters, for example, for water. Right? So you're basically pumping water through pipes mm-hmm. that are being heated by the sun. And then you're using that for hot water. And that has huge potential for developing countries. You know, one of the worries that we have is not how we might be able to deal with our energy, but as developing nations want to emulate our lifestyles, they want hot showers. They want long hot showers. That's the thinking anyway. So what happens when you take an entire town in China, and a town in China is 2 to 3 million people, and give them hot water? Well, if you do it in such a way where 90% of the households are using solar thermal heaters and are happy with it, that's a pretty incredible thing. So it's not always the cutting edge technology, but it's also taking old technology and using it in a smart way.
You've got someone looking into solar paint here, and also kind of a bubble wrap for rooftops. What are those?
Right. So that's a little bit out there in some ways, but it's, we went and visited Caltech in California. And the solar paint is basically something they believe that they can apply. You know, we actually made it in the lab in the show, and there's a segment that I actually make this stuff, but I make a tiny little amount of it. But if you can make it in scale and make it a gallons, then the belief is you could paint it onto surfaces, and it really does exactly the same thing as a photovoltaic. It generates a little bit of current in doing it. Now, of course, you have to wire it up and get the current out of it, but it can be done. At least it can be done in the lab. The bubble wrap stuff is really using solar energy, sunlight, to split up hydrogen. Split up water to create hydrogen and oxygen. The oxygen is released, the hydrogen is captured, and you have hydrogen gas, which you can then use to fuel your home, or fuel your car for that matter.
And then also in California, you looked at nuclear fusion. We heard you effusing yeah. about that. Well, clean, limitless energy, like the sun. But we've heard about it for a long time and haven't seen it. Is it still really out there as a viable alternative?
Well, they say it's the technology of tomorrow, but tomorrow never seems to come. And I agree with you that we've had many disappointments on that. Here's the thing with fusion. We know it works, right? You just have to look up at the sun, and we know it works. So we have a theoretical concept, but we can actually see it in application. It's up there in the sun. Mm-hmm. The thing is, in the sun, gravity is what allows fusion to happen. Because gravity is so great on the sun, it compresses the atoms evenly, and that's what allows fusion really to happen. On Earth, we don't have that kind of gravity, so we have to find a way to compress atoms, but do so exactly evenly. I'm holding my hand as if I'm grasping a basketball right now. And to do that, they use multiple lasers to push these atoms together, but do so incredibly evenly. It's very, very hard to do. That said, when I speak to people like Michio Kaku, who's a theoretical physicist in New York, about this, you know, he does believe that fusion is going to be something we're going to see in our lifetimes and maybe even in the next few years, and being able to demonstrate it at a temperature that's workable. Is it going to be the big silver bullet? That I'm a little bit less certain of. I feel like whenever you come up with one solution, other problems then fall into place that never make anything free. That's the one thing I've learned about energy. No matter what the technology is, no matter how great it is, there's always a cost to it. It just depends whether you're willing to pay the cost. I know there will be a cost associated with fusion if it happens. It's worth experimenting with. It's worth putting enormous amounts of support to try to make it happen because, as I said, it's a theoretical concept, but we know it does work. You can see it up there in the sky. Mm. But I won't I really think you have to try lots of different options as well in the meanwhile.
M. Sanjan is host of Discovery Channel's new series, Powering the Future. We've got lots of callers for you. Janet in Walterboro, South Carolina. Janet, you're on the air.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I'm working with the Biomass Council, South Carolina. We got several small entrepreneurs. I'm working on an energy tuber that out-yields corn 5 to 6 times with using 10% of the nitrogen. have colleagues working on a tree for oil that does about 1,500 gallons of the acre. Soybean does 700, mm-hmm. I mean 70. Mm-hmm. Another colleague working on manure. The manure from 900 dairy cows can heat and cool 600 homes with natural gas. There is no green energy bank. You cannot get funding to work on this stuff. Federal government just announced a big grant program, $300 million in about six regional centers to work on cellulosic ethanol. We can't even apply for those grants.
Why not?
And because they'll only fund switchgrass, trees, and cellulosic ethanol. And our stuff's ready to go. I mean, any hillbilly can make ethanol out of the starch or sugar crop.
Hey, Janet, we'll ask you about that, but what's an energy tuber? Do you mean tuber like a potato or something?
Yeah, it's a great big industrial sweet potato. It's like full of starch, 33% dry matter, does about 45 tons of the acre, can grow all over the southeast in California and Texas.
M. Sanjan, you hear the enthusiasm to get up and do this right there, but the concern there's not enough resources to help people do it. What did you find as you looked around? Did you find resource-starved small entrepreneurs ready to go and not supported?
Yeah, I mean, this is the story you hear all the time. I mean, the big theme of the show, at least one of the episodes of the show, is energy is all around us. And the enthusiasm here from South Carolina is, you're right, it is all around us. Don't just try one or two things. You really have to try lots of things, and the solutions are going to come in that way. It's all going to depend on the community you live in. But to do that, you know, entrepreneurs, universities, research institutes, nonprofits need to have a source of funding that they can use for R&D. You know, you look at the internet, you know, a lot of people think that the internet boom happened because, of just entrepreneurs. It was all private money. It wasn't so. There was enormous amounts of spending by the government, particularly the military in that case, to really kickstart it. And I think you need the same thing if we're going to have an energy revolution.
Let's get to Janet. Thanks for your call and good luck. Let's go to Terry in Robbins, Tennessee.
Good day, Tom.
Hi, Terry.
We can't afford not to go to alternate energies. The coal and oil industry can't hold us back forever. And just as an example, which would anybody rather live, within an eighth of a mile of a wind turbine or a solar facility, or within 2 miles of a coal-powered plant or a oil refinery?
But do you think it's out there, Terry? Is the answer really out there in alternative energies, or is it kind of chasing the wind?
10 years ago, with the capability we had on solar panels, the half the state of Tennessee could have been covered with solar panels and provided enough energy for the rest of the country. Same thing with wind energy.
So let's just go get it. Terry, we've got the perspective. M. Sanjan, please stand by in Missoula. We have on the line with us now from Oakland, California, Lisa Marganelli. She's a journalist, follows global energy, director of the Energy Policy Initiative at the New America Foundation, author of Oil on the Brain. Lisa, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
You know, all this trouble in the Gulf and what we've seen about a despoiled Gulf of Mexico has led to a lot of people to just want to get away from oil. And M. Sanjan's out there looking at all kinds of initiatives around the world. When you tote these up, Lisa, and look at what's going on in the alternative energy fuel, and you look at the demand that's growing as we head toward, what they say, maybe 9 billion by 2050 on the planet, do the lines cross somewhere? Does alternative energy fulfill the world's energy demand without fossil fuels at some point?
Well, I think fossil fuels are going to be with us for a really long time. But what we have the ability to do right now is to dramatically reduce our dependence on the fossil fuels and phase in all sorts of alternatives. You know, I love the story of the solar hot water heaters in China. There's been a study done in California that shows that putting those solar hot water heaters in the Central Valley would reduce our natural gas consumption by 5%. And in the state of California, which is about 11% of the population of the U.S., I mean, that's a significant chunk of natural gas, and it would actually affect natural gas prices for the whole West. So, we have lots of things at our disposal, but as the woman from South mm-hmm. Carolina with the energy tubers mentioned, I mean, one of the big hurdles is how do you let all these things compete, and how do you give them all access to capital? And that is a huge challenge for us one of the things about gasoline is it's so convenient. You don't even have to decide whether you're going to get gasoline. You decide which entrance to which gas station you're going to take, because every gas station has like four or five entrances.
Come on in.
Yeah. come on in, make it more convenient. You go
right
up there and everything's been designed so you don't even have to think. And what's going to start happening as we start to diversify our energy supplies is we're going to have to think.
But let me ask you, I mean, and I know there are doors slamming here at the same time. Harry Reid saying in Washington this week that because he can't get enough support, some Democrats not on board, no Republicans on board, they're pulling the plug on comprehensive climate change. We'll hear more about that legislation, that is. But hypothetically, to help people think about this, if we're going to 9 billion planetary population by 2050, if that means, and the projections are, 50% more demand for energy, Lisa, if you could open all the spigots to support alternative energy development, could we reach a point where we offset enough fossil fuels that we get out of this damaging cycle that we're in on the fossil fuel front?
Well, yeah. I mean, and one of the big, this came up in the Discovery program, one of the big things that we need to do is essentially emulate the Industrial Revolution with new forms of energy, with reducing our carbon, the amount of productivity that we extract from every unit of carbon.
What does that mean, emulate the Industrial Revolution? What do you mean by that?
Well, the Industrial Revolution took 120 years. We basically increased our productivity by 10 times over that period. And that's exactly what we need to do, but we need to do it by 2050, so that's 40 years. So we need to do basically the Industrial Revolution at triple time between now and 2050. Now, when I talk about this with people, I'm making an assumption about your age, but sort of our age, like, you know, maybe middle-aged, if people go, oh, my God. But when I talk about that with kids who are in high school or in college, they get this light in their eyes. It's like they're going to spend their entire career in a wind tunnel, like one big whoosh. And that's actually, I mean,
of change on the energy front.
Of change, just enormous change and enormous, you know, what they call out here in Silicon Valley, creative destruction, this whole, like this opportunity and at the same time, just massive sort of uprooting and change. And that is... even when you talk to people about the changes that we need to make in oil, you talk about if you start to shift away from oil-driven cars, it'll unlock something like $3 trillion in potential spending or investment that needs to be made in other sources. And so we're sort of at this period where we're still in the old period, and we haven't pushed ourselves into the new. And I think that's what Harry Reid is seeing, is that it's like nobody really wants to start the jump.
M. Sanchin, what did you see out there on your travels and in the film that's come back? Do you see us engaging with that, you know, triple time new industrial revolution toward this cumulatively in everything you witnessed, or still kind of idling, still, you know, not really in that kind of slipstream?
Well, you know, when I went around the world, I mean, the point is we don't really have that much of a choice. If America, which has been a leader on so many things, from education to medical care to, sort of the internet revolution and so on and so forth, wants to continue to remain a leader, we have to do that now.
But the funny thing is, we do have a choice. It's not happening. Climate change, comprehensive, just fell off the table. Tom Friedman says we're blowing it. We may already have blown it to China. We do have a choice. We're choosing not to go full speed, aren't we?
We're dawdling. I would agree with that. But I think that what my point is that if we want to continue to lead, and this is what Friedman says, then, you know, don't do it necessarily because you want to do something better for the planet. Do it because if you don't, you're not going to be competitive on a global stage. I mean, you just aren't. You know, yesterday I opened up The Economist magazine, page 3, full-page ad from Asia talking about alternate technologies and wind. I mean, it's unbelievable.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking after the Gulf oil blowout about getting off oil, about alternative energy ideas around the world, anything but oil. M. Sanchin, joins us from Missoula, Montana. He's lead scientist for the Nature Conservancy and host of Powering the Future on the Discovery Channel. It's aired, will re-air on Planet Green this Sunday and Monday nights. Lisa Marganelli is with us as well from Oakland, California, author of Oil on the Brain, director of the Energy Policy Initiative at the New America Foundation. Lisa, if you could draw a pie chart of, you know, what our optimum, ideal, alternative energy future looks like? And I don't know, go out to 2050 when we're supposed to have 9 billion people on this planet. How much do you think is still going to be fossil fuels at that point? And what would make up the other significant pieces of pie?
The problem with that pie is that the pie, what the pie looks like changes every year and a half or so. If you'd asked me to draw that pie, say, 6 years ago, mm-hmm. or anybody in the energy field to draw that pie, they would have made a big chunk of it as hydrogen. And now that's not even going to be a part of anyone's pie.
George Bush was talking about it in State of the Union speeches.
Absolutely. This was supposed to be our big, you know, this was, we were going to run our cars on hydrogen. And not only that, but we were going to run whole city blocks
yep.
on sort of hydrogen fed back from the cars into the buildings, hydrogen generating electricity and feeding it back into
hydrogen
the
heaven.
Buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so here's a couple of thoughts that I have. One thing is, so Stephen Chu estimates that maybe we could have 10% of our energy coming from geothermal. I'll go with that. The Scientific American thinks that maybe we could have 35% of our total energy coming from solar, and that would be a whole bunch of different types of solar. But that also includes moving up our consumption of land for solar energy from 10 square miles in 2007 to 30,000 square miles. So
okay.
That's a lot of land.
Goodbye, Rhode Island or something. Spread it.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at some of the projections for biofuels, even with switchgrass, you're looking at like the size of Spain. So there's going to be massive trade-offs. So I guess even whatever is theoretically possible has to also be politically and economically possible.
I'm still trying to get a sense of how much we're still depending on oil in your ideal pie. Half?
My ideal pie,
quarter,
I think, would take
gone?
The oil down to 15% or something like that.
You know, M. Sanjan, Bill McKibben, environmentalist, says it's too late, and that the Tom Friedman view, the sort of industrial, let's go get 'em view, is we're past the moment. And, you know, he might disagree with the MIT scientist you quoted saying it's not going to be loincloths. I mean, he says let's get really simple right now, or much simpler in the way we live, so that we just consume less. How much of the future, adaptation that we do is just going to be not gee whiz technology, Sanjan, but conservation.
Right. That's the big word that people tend not to like to use. But it's absolutely right in the sense that we have to have conservation take place. We think that by 2050, you're going to be around 22 terawatts, 22 trillion watts of energy. That's what our use is going to be every second of every day. And what we think is we could probably bring that down to 18 terawatts if we, enact conservation measures. That's not that hard to do. And I feel like you could do a lot of that without changing your happiness quotient, and probably without changing a huge amount of what you do in your life. It's amazing how individuals can make a difference. I strongly disagree with people who think that changing your light bulb or turning off the faucet or thinking about where you're driving or redoing your home is not important. It is incredibly important because it allows you then to think about bigger things like legislation. So I think conservation has to be part of this game. There's no way we're going to meet a clean energy future if we don't make it. But that does not mean it's too late. I always worry about people who say, look, it's too late. You got to throw up your hands and you're asking for a revolution. Something about the way I think is just not that. I'm not built that way. I always think that we can rise to the challenge and we can do things.
Let's go to Kathy in Ashland, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm calling about a very supposedly, in quotes, new fuel that's actually incredibly ancient. It's called biochar. And I found out about it by reading the book 1491 by Charles C. Mann. And they talk
biochar, like charcoal, Kathy?
Yes, but bio is a very important component
okay.
of it. I found out about it because I was Googling something called terra preta out of the book 1491, and I kept finding references to biochar and a whole bunch of research being done on biochar. Finally, I was like, what is this stuff? And I realized that it's the new terra preta. The people are trying to make this terra preta. And the fascinating thing about terra preta is that it's 5 and 10,000 years old, and it's still self-fertile.
Let us pick it up, Kathy. And look, M. Sanjan, what about biochar? What do you know?
You know, I've heard of it, but I don't know enough about it to comment on it. We didn't look at it on the program, and part of that was just simply because there's just too many things out there to really look at within 4 hours.
Lisa Marganelli, what can you tell us?
Well, biochar is actually one of the – so biochar is it's pyrolysis of biomass. So you basically take your biomass, like the olive pits that are in the Discovery Channel show, and you blast them with heat and possibly pressure. I'm not too up on the chemistry of this. And you end up with this black goo that can actually and people at the University of Iowa and other places are actually working on this as kind of a pathway for making biofuels that you'd take old corn stalks and things like mm-hmm. that, blast them into the black goo, and then you could run the black goo through a standard refinery. So you're making sort of like a precursor of what oil is. Then what the caller's talking about the terra preta, is this business of burying the char in the ground in these it was a planting style that was used in South America and seemed to have led to in kind of incredible zones of fertility that probably ultimately led to all of us being here and being able to eat corn and, you know, become fat and happy.
sounds
probably has actually a big part of role in our lives, but that we don't understand. But the biochar and the whole process of pyrolysis is another promising pathway for biofuels. But again, there are so many variables in biofuels of the land, fertilizer, water. And one of the things I feel that we have to have optimism about the future. You know, we were talking about the optimism.
Mm-hmm.
We have to try to tackle this problem rather than just saying, oh, it's too late. I don't think I don't see how you can possibly go forward. I don't see how you can even say to your kids, oh, you know, sorry, we didn't really feel like doing anything, so we're not going to have any auto industry by 2025.
Now, I don't want to misrepresent. I think even those who say it's too late, what they mean is, yes, we have to do everything we can, but it's too late to avoid some significant and painful environmental changes. And a big part of an emergency reaction to that may be just a change in lifestyle. But no, we're not ruling out anything. We're not ruling out even black goo. I want to get Nick from Bowling Green, Kentucky on. Nick, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I guess what I'd like to say is that even in the event that we do develop alternative energy, which I believe is something that will definitely happen, it's not going to be this new American energy industry that the president and a lot of other people are talking about.
Why not?
Anything that can be outsourced will be outsourced, basically, is what I'm saying. Even if the best case scenario is that the technology is invented in America, as soon as that technology gets corporate backing, they're going to outsource the manufacturing, they're going to outsource the support for it, they're going to outsource everything they can just to make more money off of it.
Well, we hope you're not right, but we've all seen evidence that can certainly happen. We've even seen it happen in alternative energies. I think, you know, some wind production, some solar production gone offshore. I want to bring a voice in right here, Nick, if I may, from Washington. David Herzenhorn joins us. He's congressional correspondent for the New York Times. There's been a lot going on the climate front, and that, of course, relates to energy very much. Just this week, a lot going on or not going on. David, thank you for joining us.
Hello from the U.S. Capitol.
What happened to comprehensive climate change legislation this week?
Well, last year it was approved in the House of Representatives, but no such luck in the United States Senate. We sort of knew that that was where things were headed for quite a while now, but finally yesterday the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid came out of a lunchtime meeting with fellow Democrats and said it out loud, what we sort of all understood, which is that there are not the votes, at least not now, not this summer, for a comprehensive climate change bill, and they're going to scale back even further. Already, the Democrats had said that they didn't see how they could attempt a broad cap on carbon emissions and would try to focus on something specifically aimed at power plants, utility companies, but even that doesn't have the votes right now.
Your colleague there at the New York Times on the opinion page, Tom Friedman, has been writing recently that, you know, people ought to get on board with this. In fact, sort of desperately saying, you know, all you need, seven Republicans coming over would do it. And without it, we're going to lose out enormously economically in this country. If it's not passed in this term, in November, Republicans may well grow stronger. I mean, what does it mean about when this might be back on the table, David?
Well, it's going to be difficult. Look, we leave the opinion making to our friends on the editorial page, but politically, this is a very difficult time. You have a midterm, highly competitive midterm election looming in just about 3 months. It's very difficult to move anything through the Senate. Normally, given the fractious politics, now, with everything that's going on, it's especially tough. And this is a complicated, tough issue.
Complicated and tough, and now at least in a big way that controls carbon, maybe put off for years. David Herzenhorn with the New York Times, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Lisa, what does this matter? If this doesn't happen, does it throw a monkey wrench into expectations about alternative energy development in this country?
Well, one of the things that we desperately need for alternative energy development is we need to have a price on carbon. And we also need to move the subsidies that we put towards fossil fuels, which are really enormous, more towards alternative fuels. So we need to sort of shift the prices. Right now, when you go buy gasoline, you might think that the price at the tank is expensive, but in fact, you pay an enormous amount through your taxes on April 15th that you never see.
But that price on carbon is exactly what won't happen without comprehensive climate legislation.
Exactly. So, I mean, there's a possibility that some other climate bill will pass. I think it's and another possibility is that you can pass something called renewable portfolio standards, which is that you require utilities to obtain an increasing amount of their power from renewable sources. But, you know, it's discouraging. And it's also discouraging in the wake of the enormous Deepwater Horizon spill that is just, you know, it's surpassed every spill that's ever happened around U.S. waters. It's enormous. And the fact that we couldn't somehow gather the political guts together to go and do something about the future so that this doesn't happen is quite sad and discouraging.
Let me go to Roslindale, Massachusetts, if I may, and Stefan. Stefan, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Listen, it's been a real interesting program and listening about, hopeful sources of energy in the future, but I'm thinking more about the stuff that's available right now. You know, I mean, things that we see in place in other countries and even in our own country in some places, such as wind farms and solar arrays.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what is, you know, I feel frustration because, you know, we had this big spike in gas prices a few years ago and gas went up over $4 a gallon. And I started to hear a lot of talk about these things becoming a reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why can't we put some people to work who are not working in constructing some wind farms and some solar arrays? I mean, I hear that, it takes a lot of land. Well, we have a lot of land in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the government, I think, owns over 50% of the land in the U.S. We've got plenty of room to put these places. What is it really? My sense is that it's political and that left to the oil companies to research and develop these alternative sources, which is sort of seems to be what's going to happen. That we'll be waiting a long time. It's never going to happen.
Stefan, let us pick it up. I mean, part of what it takes is, as Lisa says, probably putting some price on carbon to make all these other things more economically advantageous. M. Sanjin, when you're out talking with innovators on the energy front, I mean, they're doing a lot already. You're bringing it back. You're reporting on it. You're telling us about it. But to really get this thing, off to the races, what do they tell you it's going to take?
They're telling me that it's going to take the American public getting behind it. I mean, you cannot sit this one out. And what astonishes me is that we really always think that politicians and governments lead. They don't. They don't really lead. It's people who sort of lead, and then governments and politicians get the act together and sort of follow. And I think on this issue, the whole point of me making the show and Discovery putting the effort behind making the show is to inform people what's out there, what's possible, what are other countries doing? Because I really believe if people watch this and get involved in it, they will demand action. It is astonishing, as Lisa said, that if you can't pass a comprehensive clean energy bill now, what are they doing? I mean, how can you be against the oil spill in the Gulf and not want to pass a clean energy bill?
And what does that mean for us ultimately? I mean, what's the difference between succeeding in this and not in terms of its consequences?
if you want America to remain a first-rate power in on the world and be a leader in the world, we have to do this. That's just from our narrow perspective. From a global perspective, it will completely change how much we're going to have to spend eventually to adapt to changes on the planet. So we're going to pay for this now or later, and it's a lot cheaper to do it now than to wait 50 years and pass it along to our kids.
And if we open the way for this, really put our shoulder to the wheel, do you come back optimistic we can make a big difference?
Absolutely. I mean, you see it in action in China, in Europe, in other places, but at small scales. If America gets behind this, I truly believe that almost nothing is impossible. And this certainly is not impossible. This is a reality even here in America today. It just needs the kind of investment and support from government and from the private sector, and I guess I would say from the nonprofits as well, to really turn the corner.
Let the people lead on it, you say. And
let the people lead.
There's one to hope for.
Call your elected representative today and tell them you want something.
It's high time. We've seen maybe enough oil, enough to know we need to get behind it. M. Sanjan, lead scientist with the Nature Conservancy, host of the Discovery Channel's Powering the Future series, airing Sunday and Monday nights on Planet Green. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Lisa Marganelli with the New America Foundation, author of Oil on the Brain. Lisa, thank you for your insights today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being here. Great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.